Mia, aren't you that profiler on the slasher case?
Aye, I said in a faraway voice.
Yeah, I saw you on the telly last night. You should speak to DCI Copeland. He's leading the investigation into Handler's death. If you can spare any time, I bet he'd be pleased to get your take on things.
Just the in I needed.
Chapter 59. Major Incident Room, Scotland Yard, 1517. Fontaine doesn't fit the profile, I said to Isakson, giving it yet another go. While we were sitting around with our thumbs up our asses, the real killer was out there sharpening his knife. All I'm asking is you divvy up your resources. Don't put all your bodies behind him.
When you first came on board, I told you I'd had problems working with military types before. I appreciate your input with regards to profiling. However, I don't appreciate you telling me how to manage my team.
A pulse throbbed visibly at his temple. I'm not telling you how to manage your team. I'm telling you you've got the wrong man in there.
Perhaps you should go and get some air, Mackenzie. Come back when your head's cooler.
Jeez, talking to this guy was about as useful as a butter kettle. 5 minutes later, I was knocking on DCI Copeland's door, the man heading up the investigation into Handler's death. If Isakson wouldn't listen to me, there were other ways I could occupy my time.
Ziba,
said Copeland, standing up and coming round from behind his desk to shake my hand.
I've heard all about you from Falcon. It's good of you to stop by.
Like I said on the phone, I'm happy to help if I can.
I appreciate that. Just so you know, though, we're not treating Handler's death as suspicious. But when one of our own dies like this, we like to check it all out, dot the I's, cross the T's and all that.
All I know is the scuttlebutt I picked up in the cafeteria, but what makes you so quick to rule out foul play? My understanding is Handler had everything to live for. He was getting married. His fiancée's expecting.
True, but according to his DI, Kurt Watkiss, Handler's been under a lot of stress recently. Hasn't been himself. Anxious, depressed. So much so, Watkiss tried to get him to take some leave, or at least see a GP.
And did he?
Seems not.
Anyone else say he seems stressed and depressed?
All the chaps in his department, everyone's noticed it.
What about his girlfriend?
Sounds like he kept it hidden from her, but then he would, wouldn't he? Under the circumstances, I mean. She did say he seemed riled up the day he died, though. A bird on a wire, is how she put it.
Was that because of me? And what about the gun he used?
Glock 9mm. He signed it out of lockup yesterday evening.
When?
8:55 p.m.
Less than 10 minutes after I put down the phone to him. What about TOD?
ME puts it at around 11:30 last night.
Right around the time he should have been on his way over to meet me. So why had he put a bullet to his brain instead?
Chapter 60. Copeland might not be treating Handler's death as suspicious, but it certainly felt that way to me. Though I had to be careful not to jump to conclusions. One of the first things we were taught during basic training was to assume nothing, regardless of how clear-cut a situation might seem. Act on knowledge, not theories, we were told. Losing your head can cost you your head. I thought back to Handler's voice last night, how nervous he'd sounded. Had he had second thoughts about coming over? Did that have anything to do with what happened next? If only I knew what he'd been going to tell me.
Can I have a look at the forensic photos? I said to Copeland.
Knock yourself out, he said, reaching over for a manila file. Take a seat here, make yourself comfy.
He put the folder on a small round table in front of his desk set with four chairs. I took the photographs out and laid them out in a line. There were a series of pictures taken from the interior and exterior of Handler's vehicle
in varying degrees of close-up. The high-force impact of the shot in a confined space had produced a blowback effect, splattering fine droplets of blood in a backwards and forwards direction over the windows and seats. Handler had held the gun to the side of his head, pressing the muzzle against his skin, creating a deep star-shaped laceration, red around the edges, a black hole in the centre. There was a grey abrasion ring around the wound, and leaking from it, a tear-like trickle of blood. A thought nagged, but I couldn't nail it down.
Was his fiancée at home at the time of the incident?
No, she'd gone out with friends. I ran my hand through my hair, trying to see things the way he had. Handler had his digs to himself, so why did he go to his car to kill himself? Why didn't he stay indoors, where he wouldn't be disturbed and could have some privacy for this awful final act? I continued to scrutinise the pictures. The thought still nagged. Something wasn't right, but what? I picked up another photo, an external view of the car. It wasn't parked on a residential street. It looked to be in an industrial area, somewhere off the beaten track. So he did want privacy then. But why leave the house, given he was alone there anyway? Was it because he wanted to spare his fiancée the horror of finding him? I thought of the picture I'd seen on his desk, and how in love the two of them had looked. Yes, he could have knocked himself off in an out-of-the-way place to spare her feelings. Which meant this wasn't about their relationship. The next picture was a wide-angled photo taking in the whole scene. As I looked at it, the nagging thought came into focus, in full technicolor detail. Gavin Handler didn't kill himself, I said. He was murdered.
Chapter 61.
Murdered? Said Copeland. What makes you say that?
For starters, the gunshot wounds on the right side of his head.
I don't follow.
Gavin Handler was left-handed.
How do you know that?
I saw him writing at his desk the other day, but not just that. Look where his watch is.
On his right wrist.
I nodded. Check with his girlfriend if you want. She'll be able to confirm it, but I can tell you there's no way a left-handed person would shoot themselves the way Handler supposedly has. Copeland rubbed his forehead.
Supposedly? We found GSR on his hands. He was holding the gun.
Someone staged the scene, took forensic countermeasures. They wanted it to look like suicide, and they knew what they were doing. Shit, said Copeland. He exhaled loudly through his nostrils.
There's more.
See here, there are nail marks on the steering wheel, made recently, I'd guess. Suggests duress. If you can get the vehicle on CCTV, you'll see Handler was driving erratically, braking too hard, weaving about, while the pathology report will show traces of sweat on his hands.
Where are you going with this?
I think Handler got in his car and was jumped by someone with a gun. I think this person held the weapon to the back of Handler's head and forced him to drive to an isolated location, and then he shot him in the side of the head. Copeland puffed out his cheeks, gerbil-like. Check the back of his head. If I'm right, there'll be an indentation from the muzzle, possibly gunshot residue too. Copeland pulled at the loose skin on his gullet. His day had just got a whole lot busier. The man who shot him is in his late 30s. He received a dishonourable discharge from the military, and he lives alone. He's a professional, highly organised, efficient, and physically fit. And the firearm he used suggests he has a link to Scotland Yard.
Chapter 62. Major Incident Room, Scotland Yard, 1602. I headed back to the incident room, my brain firing in every direction. Gavin Handler had been killed on his way to see me. Right after our phone call, someone checked out a gun in his name, and his death had been a professional hit. Those things had to be connected. Someone didn't want him talking to me, though what about Duncan or Sunlight? If Duncan's murder was linked to Sunlight, it's possible Handler's was too, given it came so soon after his call to me. On top of that, both homicides were executions. Both involved firearms, and judging by the photos I'd seen, both were carried out by a highly skilled shooter. Maybe even the same person. What was it about Sunlight that made people ready to kill for it? And who'd ordered the hits? Was this really an inside job? It seemed far-fetched. And yet. I rubbed my temples. I might be onto something, but how could I find out for sure if I was right? Not only was I unable to snatch more than a handful of minutes at a go to check things out, but it seemed every time I kicked down one wall, another sprang up in its place. Bodie Calder had revoked my access to Duncan's work files. Watkiss was warning me off, and now Gavin Handler had been killed on his way to meet me. What a snafu.
Mackenzie,
said D.I. Isakson as I walked into the MIR, my head a million miles away from the Primrose Hill case.
I want to make a press announcement saying we have Tristan Fontaine in custody. Would you care to word a statement?
It wasn't a question. Never mind walls. I couldn't even say the word Sunlight without my attention being called elsewhere. With Handler having just been shot, possibly by the same person who'd killed Duncan, the thorn of my frustration was digging deeper than ever. Which is why I was more than usually pissed at having to do desk work. I should be hunting down Handler's shooter, not being Isakson's little secretary. And on top of that, he was making the wrong call.
I'm not sure that's the best strategy, sir, I said.
He sighed.
I'm getting a bit tired of this. I don't expect to have to debate every instruction I give you. I'm not trying to draft it, please, Mackenzie.
The offender's using these murders to make a point, I said, staring him down. He wants to show he's powerful, unstoppable, and he's almost certainly enjoying the media attention. Take the spotlight off him by shining it on someone else, and he'll lash out by killing again. Isakson's phone buzzed in his pocket.
Put something together, please. I'd like it to go out in half an hour.
It's a mistake, I said. But he was already walking away, checking his mobile. I watched him for a moment, noting how his posture had changed. A second earlier, he'd been standing tall. Now his shoulders were slumped. The message he'd just got had upset him, though something about his body language told me it had nothing to do with the case. What's chewing this guy up? I thought, going back to my desk. Apart from the fact he's got a big green vena up his arse. I sat down and put a brief sheet together, adding an extra bit about how we were exploring all avenues. When I'd finished, I emailed it over to the press office, then dialed Bodie Calder's extension. I'd had enough of being shut down and sticking Duncan's homicide in the bottom drawer. It was time to get some answers. D.I. Calder's in the canteen, his secretary said when she answered the phone. As I hurried to the lifts, I clamped down on a disturbing thought. Finding out what happened to Duncan might set me free, but it might just as easily kill me first. Chapter 63 Cafeteria, Scotland Yard, 1632 Calder, we need to talk, I said, spotting him emptying a sweet and low sachet into a polystyrene cup. I noticed Watkiss sitting on his own at the back of the canteen doing something intricate with a small grey device. There were a load of gizmos spread out in front of him, and a sugar donut to his right. I instinctively angled my body away from him.
Do you have the flash drive for me?
B.O. said, glancing at someone I didn't recognise over at a table by the window. Not just yet, afraid I've had a few other things on my mind.
Yeah, I heard you've got the gynaecologist in custody. Congratulations.
His personal hygiene hadn't improved any more than his tact.
Do you want to go and sit down?
He said. No need, it'll only take a minute. I wanted to watch him while I put a few questions to him, A table would hide his hands and feet. Standing up, I could take in the whole show. He shrugged.
So, about that flash drive.
He flicked his gaze over to the window table again and spread his legs wide. Actually, I wanted to talk to you about Operation Sunlight, Bodhi. He blanched and glanced again at the window table. Who was he looking at? You know what sunlight is, don't you?
No idea what you're talking about.
He squeezed his lips together. It left him with a slit for a mouth. I think you do.
I told you I've never heard of it.
He squeezed his lips again. It's a visop, isn't it? I said, my eyes trained on his face, watching his reactions, the twitch of his nostrils, the infinitesimal movements round his eyes. His micro-expressions would tell me what I needed to know. Watkiss is part of it, something to do with prostitution. No? Okay, something underhand. Yes, money-related?
This is ridiculous, I have to go.
I smiled sweetly. Of course, thank you for your time, you've been very helpful. He glanced at the window table again and stroked the wristband of his fancy new watch, his face the colour of the pink sweetener packet in his hand.
What are you talking about? I haven't told you anything.
Oh, but you have, I said. Just not with words, that's all. Chapter 64. I was on my way back up to the incident room when my mobile rang. Axel Montong.
I understand you have Yasmin's husband in custody.
He'd been following the news then. Aye, that's right.
So, can I assume you won't need to come into the offices again? It's a little disruptive having the place crawling with detectives when we've got clients in.
So, this wasn't about a concern for justice. The shitbird was still on about his precious bloody firm. It was tempting to send a SWAT team in just to see the look on his face. I settled for sticking it to him instead. Tristan Fontaine hasn't been charged yet, and depending on how things develop this end, it may well be that we need to re-interview certain members of your staff. I should also prepare you for the fact there might be a lot of media interest around Scott and Montong over the next few days.
Listen, I've been very cooperative so far, more than cooperative, and you did assure me you'd keep the firm's name out of the public domain.
We both knew I'd done no such thing. We appreciate your cooperation, just as I'm sure you'll appreciate we have very little control over what the press chooses to run with.
Yes, of course.
His tone changed, as if someone had flipped a switch on his voice box.
I do understand, I'm sorry. It's just this has all been quite upsetting.
Aggressive to charming, in the bat of an eye. My Porsche would struggle to go from 0 to 10 as fast. The charm was a front, though, as phony as the plug socket concealing Duncan's flash drive.
Did I tell you Lily Abian and I got stuck in a lift together on Tuesday morning?
You're talking about the day she was killed?
Yeah, it jammed for 30 minutes, jolly unpleasant. I have claustrophobia, you see.
Poor diddums.
I'd never really spoken to Lily properly before. We had a good chat in there. Apparently she'd just broken up with her boyfriend, said he was giving her a bit of a hard time over it.
Why didn't you mention this before?
I didn't think it was relevant.
He paused.
Listen, there's a place down the road from the office, Little Bangkok. I order from it a lot. They do a wonderful black pepper salmon. Why don't you come by? 8 o'clock? We can have a bite to eat, crack open a bottle of Riesling, and I can tell you all about my conversation with Lily. You find out a lot about a person stuck in a lift. Do come over later. I'd like to think I was doing something to help.
It may have been a good opportunity to get some decent intel, but it wasn't protocol, that's for sure. Isaacson wouldn't like it one bit. I didn't hesitate. See you at 8, I said. I never have been good with rules. It hit me as soon as I hung up. Yasmin Pejman had also had Thai food the night she was killed. Had it come from Little Bangkok? And had she eaten with Axel Montan?
Chapter 65. What have I done? He'll be home any minute. How could I have let this happen? Never mind Dutch courage. I should have known where one little drink would lead. There's a car door slamming shut outside. Someone's walking up the path. Oh God, is it him? Am I too late? A package just dropped through the letterbox. The footsteps are receding. Thank goodness. It's just a delivery then, not him. Yet. If I'm going to do this, I've got to go now. I can't afford to wait. Though what's he going to say when he sees the mess? He'll know I've been drinking. He's going to go mad. For Christ's sakes, I've got to focus. All that matters is I get to the police station while I still have the chance. I know what he's capable of. The proof's right here in front of me.
Chapter 66. Skatten Montong, Clerkenwell, 2000. It was raining bullets when my taxi pulled up outside the Skatten Montong offices. Just like the nights the victims were killed, I thought. And now I'm off to eat the same last supper as Yasmin Pejman. The radio in the cab had said another storm was on its way. Squalls with winds up to 60 miles per hour lasting through to tomorrow morning. Damn! I must have left my umbrella in the office, I thought as I paid the driver. So much for always being prepared. Holding my bag over my head for cover, I jumped out the cab and legged it into the building. I hadn't mentioned my dinner date to the DI or anyone else on the team. I knew they'd try and stop me going if I did. Or worse, insist on tagging along. I'd bring it up in the morning if anything came of it. In the meantime, I'd go it alone. Always my preferred play. Partnering up's just about mitigating risk. Axel Montan may be about as warm as a box of fish fingers, and he might have eaten with Pejman the night she died, but that doesn't mean he's the perp, I thought. His wife did give him an alibi after all. Twice. My dinner plans weren't the only thing I was keeping to myself. I still hadn't mentioned the car from yesterday. Fact is, I didn't want to go crying to Isaacson, and that's how he'd have seen it if I'd brought it up. And even if he hadn't, I would. We weren't exactly seeing eye to eye at the moment. I didn't want the guy's help or to give him anything over me. You're too proud, Duncan used to say. There's nothing wrong with letting people in occasionally. I let you in, I thought. And look where that bloody got me. Ziba Mackenzie, I'm here to see Axel Montan, I said to the groomed-to-perfection woman sitting on reception. Everything at S&M was just so. Axel Montan, with his glossy hair and head-to-toe labels, fitted right in. I'd hate to be married to a man like him, I thought. I bet he's even worse at home than he is at work. Control freaks like that always are. I was just sitting down on one of the white leather sofas and reaching for a newspaper when my mobile vibrated in the pit of my bag. I'd put it on silent for the team briefing. One of Isaacson's little rules. I pulled it out. There was no name on the screen, just the word withheld, same as when Handler had phoned yesterday. Mackenzie speaking. There was a pause before the caller answered.
You need to forget about sunlight. Understand? You need to back off.
Then the line went dead. The caller hadn't identified himself, but he didn't need to. I knew the voice. Bodhi Calder. And his tone was unmistakable. He was sending a warning. Chapter 67. There was no question now. Bodhi Calder knew about sunlight. But how? It was a vice operation, and he worked in homicide. The departments weren't just at opposite ends of the building. They were completely unrelated. He must have come across the op in connection with Duncan's case. The gang shooting line was a fob-off. He knows Sunlight's at the root of his murder. So why did he shut me down when I said I thought the homicide was linked to something Duncan was working on? I thought back to the meeting we'd had in his office on Wednesday night, how I'd noticed his fancy new watch and asked him if he'd robbed a bank, how he'd tensed as if I'd touched a nerve, and how he'd stroked it when I suggested he check out Sunlight. I chewed my lip, the memories coming together to form an idea. Rolex, I typed into the search engine on my phone and clicked the top result. A link to the official Rolex site. It didn't take long to spot Calder's model. An Oyster Perpetual 39 with a stainless steel bracelet and dark rhodium dial, retailing at over $4,000. There's no way a guy on a DI's salary could have afforded that without a leg up. And if I was right, I'd just worked out the kind of help he'd had. The other day, I'd thought maybe he was gambling. That'd certainly have explained the windfall and the guilt. But now I reckoned there was another reason, and his phone call just now backed up my theory nicely. So did the way he'd kept looking over at the person sitting at the window table in the cafeteria earlier when we were talking, and how he'd drained white when I mentioned Sunlight down there. As the druggie in the Deerstalker said, once you eliminate the impossible. Yes, the more I thought about it, the surer I became. Bodie Calder didn't just know about Sunlight. He was being paid to keep shtum about it. If Gavin Handler's death was anything to go by, the person bribing him might well be a Scotland Yarder, and they had the means to order a hit. No wonder Calder had sounded so scared. Chapter 68.
Ms. Mackenzie, I'm so sorry for keeping you waiting, said Axel Monton, coming into the reception area 30 minutes late for our meeting. I hope you're hungry. My secretary's ordered us a feast.
We rode the lift up to his office, a grand affair on the top floor with a stunning view of the city.
In the gods, he said, waving his arm expansively at the window.
He was talking about how high up we were, but I couldn't help feeling he had something else in mind too.
I always think it looks better at night, he said, cold blue eyes flicking over me as I took in the view.
Hundreds of fairy lights in a sea of black. It was breathtaking. He handed me a glass of chilled Riesling, another thing Isaacson would have frowned on, but I wasn't in the mood to turn it down. Alcohol was just what I wanted. Is this your wife? She's very pretty. I picked up a silver photo frame off his desk. A picture of him and a model beautiful woman on a yacht, their faces tanned and sunlit. It was the sort of shot you could have pulled right out of Hello magazine. Real A-lister glamour. The frame was polished and the picture was displayed outwards, there for show. You really are all about appearances, aren't you, Axel? I thought. And when a person's that bothered about how other people view them, it's usually because there's something about themselves they want to keep the world from seeing. But what secret was Axel Monton hiding? I looked at the photo of his wife. She was waifishly thin, her dark hair professionally blow-dried, a massive rock on her finger and a diamond tennis bracelet hanging off her bony wrist. Another person for whom outward appearances mattered. But although she had the same capped-toothed smile he did, there was a sadness in her eyes, and she was standing a good half meter away from him. Not close then, I thought, either physically or emotionally. As he dished out crab cakes and papaya salad, another thought occurred to me. She had the same colouring as Yasmin Pejman. If things weren't so good between Monton and the wifey, might he have tangled the sheets with our victim? Was Axel Monton Mr. Big? And if so, was Pejman his only conquest? What if he'd been doing the dirty with Abian too? There was no evidence to support that, but it would explain why he'd used a burner phone and insisted Pejman keep his identity to herself. He wouldn't have wanted his mistresses talking out of school and spoiling his fun. Axel Montand was arrogant, controlling, and possibly psychopathic. A man like that would have no qualms about stringing two women along. Or about disposing of them if they started causing trouble. Chapter 69. "No, really, I've had enough," I said as Axel Montand tried to top me up again. I was drinking more than I should, especially in the company of a possible suspect. I don't usually have a problem holding my drink, but the wine was going to my head. I'd only had two glasses, but I was definitely starting to feel the effects.
"Go on, just a drop."
Persistent.
"Are you trying to get me drunk?"
I said, deliberately flirtatious. I needed to catch him off guard with what I had coming next. And coquettishness neutralizes challenging every time.
He didn't go for it, though.
"Not at all."
He put the bottle down as if I'd offended him. Maybe I had.
"So how are things going with the investigation? Any developments I should be aware of?"
Cold as anything. But it suited me, gave me a natural lead-in. "I shouldn't tell you this," I said, swirling the wine round my glass, making it look like my barriers were down and I was just letting this slip. I paused, as though wrestling with whether or not to tell him. Montand leaned forward, interested.
"Shouldn't tell me what?"
"Yasmin was having an affair. Someone she worked with, we think." I eyed him closely, gauging his reaction. If Axel Montand was Mr. Big, he'd flush. He wouldn't be able to help himself. The guy may be a control freak, but even he couldn't control the animal part of his brain. But his colour didn't change.
"Are you sure? That sort of thing's more than frowned on here."
He ran a finger round the inside of his shirt collar, which made me wonder if he'd been breaking his own rules. "And yet you all go boozing together."
"That's different. We try and foster a team spirit, and socializing's an important part of that. But what you're talking about, well, that's completely different."
"Say two people broke the rules, got jiggy, and were found out. What would happen to them?" He didn't hesitate.
"They'd be asked to leave."
"So if Mr. Big did work at S&M and Pejman threatened to go public with their relationship, he'd have quite a bit to lose. And as everyone knows, desperate people do desperate things." Chapter 70. Axel Montand had invited me over to talk about Lily Abien, but he clearly had another goal in mind, keeping S&M out of the papers. Perhaps he thought I'd be a softer touch than Ruddock, easier to manipulate. More fool him. There was a knock at the door as I was getting up to leave. Nice food, shame about the company. And Dan Harper walked in. He'd taken off his suit jacket and rolled up his shirt sleeves. The guy clearly worked out. He looked good. And I wasn't the only one who thought so. Montand had pinked as soon as Harper appeared. Now he was running one hand through his hair and mashing his wedding ring with the thumb of the other. Emotional discomfort, preening and pacifying. I hadn't seen that one coming. So Axel Montand's got the hots for Dan Harper, I thought. 21st century and the boys stuck in the closet. Married and living a lie. It explained his need to dominate. He was obsessed with controlling others because he couldn't get a handle on his own desires. Classic. S&M was big on diversity hires, but it was an old-fashioned firm with old-fashioned values. And from what I'd read before our initial meeting, it wouldn't surprise me if Mr. Montand Sr. was a big-time homophobe. To get his fancy-dancy office in the gods, Axel Montand would have had to play the part Daddy expected of him. He'd needed a wife, some submissive type who'd look pretty and keep her mouth shut, and who'd wound up with a serious addiction to diet pills by the looks of her. But given the way he was ogling his crush now, while symbolically crushing his wedding band, she was clearly someone he'd like to get rid of.
"I was going to head off, unless you need me for anything else," said Harper.
He was talking to Montand, but his torso was angled towards me, and his right foot was in the starter position, pointing at the door. He didn't share his boss's feelings then.
"I'll walk out with you," I said. "Thanks for dinner, Axel."
"Pleasure. You'll think about what I said."
I put on a diplomatic face and murmured something non-committal. I wasn't promising this guy anything. Chapter 71. Harper and I rode the lift down. He made a go at small talk, but his heart wasn't in it, and I wasn't giving him much to work with. My mind was elsewhere. Axel Montand might be gay, but although that knocked him out of the running for the role of Mr. Big, it didn't mean he wasn't our perp. On Wednesday, I'd told the team he didn't fit the profile, but now I wasn't so sure. The signature suggested an offender with a deep-seated hatred of women. Montand was in the closet, forced to live a lie and take on a wife he didn't want. That could easily lead to hatred of the fairer sex, especially in a man with a psychopathic mindset who would be incapable of taking moral responsibility for his own actions. And what if it was his mother who'd shoehorned him into the mold he wasn't made for? Wouldn't that emasculate him and make him hate her too? The uterus is a symbol of motherhood. What better way to figuratively destroy the woman who gave birth to him than by cutting out his victim's wombs? It was all hypothetical at this stage. An interview with Montand's parents would tell me more. I'd set one up first thing in the morning. We reached the exit. It was still tipping it down.
"It's foul out here," Harper said, looking into the rain. "Can I give you a ride?"
"Where are you headed?"
"Chalcot Crescent, the only pink house on the street."
He laughed.
"My wife's choice of colour, not mine."
"Nothing wrong with pink," I said, smiling. "Chalcot Crescent's Primrose Hill, isn't it?"
"That's right. I guess you must be quite familiar with the area, given what's been going on."
"You could say that, but look, I'm all the way over in Little Venice, and with Friday traffic..."
"It's no problem. You don't want to be out in this. Come on, I'm parked just round the corner."
I wasn't going to argue, not with a storm raging. Heads bent against the rain, we ran over to a 3-series, its hazard lights flashing as Harper unlocked it with his key fob. Isaacson would not approve, I thought, jumping in. The car was the same make as the one I'd thought was tailing me yesterday. Was it a coincidence? Or something more? Inside, the vehicle was spotless. A magic tree air freshener was hanging from the rearview mirror. The car itself smelled like it had been recently valeted. Harper takes more care of his wheels than himself, I thought. He'd remembered his watch today, but his shirt was buttoned wrong. I took the chance to talk to him about the murder victims. 2 birds, 1 stone.
"You know, you look a bit like them, actually,"
he said, as we sped off into the filthy night. Chapter 72. Clerkenwell, 21-27. The storm was going full throttle. Even on Max, the car's wipers were useless against the rain pounding the windscreen. Inside, it was hot and stuffy, the heating cranked up all the way. A crack of thunder, the sound of bones breaking, amplified by 100. Then a flash of light in the dark sky. We were close to the eye.
"It was like this the night she died," said Harper.
His voice was quiet. It was hard to hear him above the noise of the fan.
"I keep thinking of her final moments. What must have gone through her head? How much pain she was in."
She? Her? There were 2 victims,
Why was Harper focusing on just one?
What's going to happen to her husband?
So it was Pejman he was talking about. Perhaps because it's Fontaine we've arrested, I thought.
You'll have to apply for a holding extension if you don't charge him soon. His 24 hours is nearly up.
Another one who'd been following things closely. Doing the maths, too. We'll have to see, I said, politic for a change. He jerked his head in my direction, his eyes wide.
You don't think he did it?
I didn't say that.
Your voice did.
A profiler, eh? I thought. Guess in his job, you have to be good at reading people. We're keeping an open mind, that's all. He laughed. It sounded hollow.
I've used that line. I know what it means.
Sometimes things mean what they say on the tin, I said, trying to lighten the tone. It wasn't just the air that had suddenly got a bit stuffy.
Do you have any other suspects in view?
The investigation's ongoing.
So you are still looking?
He didn't phrase it as a question.
Do you have any leads?
I glanced at him out of the corner of my eye. An interest in how we were getting on I could understand, but this was overkill. And with that thought, another came quick on its tail. Was there another reason Dan Harper had offered me a lift home? Chapter 73. Is there something you want to tell me? I said, twisting in my seat to get a better view of him. He pressed his lips together, his eyes stretched infinitesimally. His limbic brain had taken over, the part adapted for survival situations. The cues were clear. Dan Harper was covering something up. I looked him over, putting it all together, built like an all-American hero, stressed out, overly interested in the case, focusing on Pejman. How long were you and Yasmin having sex? I said. Bullet out the blue, best way to get a reaction. And a clear read. He turned purple.
You think I was sleeping with Yasmin? What do you mean? I am married. I was not sleeping with her. I promise.
People do a number of things when they lie. They repeat the accusation. You think I was sleeping with Yasmin? They're guarded. What do you mean? They don't use contractions. I was not sleeping with her. They employ euphemisms. Sleeping with Yasmin. And bolstering statements. I promise. Dan Harper wasn't just crap at hiding the truth. He was also our Mr. Big. He'd been with Pejman the night she'd died. And from what Axel Montand had said about workplace relationships, he had plenty to lose if the affair came to light. But Pejman wasn't the only victim. Lily Abian had been killed too, though Pejman was the only one he was talking about. This wasn't about an interest in the crime then. It was about an interest in his girlfriend. I was just settling back in my seat when he came out with it.
How much influence do you have over the investigation?
As much as anyone else.
Right.
A moment later, he was swinging off the main road and taking us down a potholed side street into an industrial area with no houses and very little lighting. We were in the middle of bumfuck nowhere, just like where Handler had met his maker last night. Nice place? I was trying to sound breezy. But this time, Harper didn't answer. Chapter 74. I hadn't slept properly in 48 hours. I'd been drinking, and Gavin Handler's murder was eating at me. Was I overreacting, or was I in danger? Harper was being squirrely. He'd taken us into the boonies, and I was trapped in a BMW 3 Series. The Bimmer wasn't just the same make and model as the car tailing me yesterday.
The vehicle pulling out of the side road near the crime scene on Wednesday had been a 3 Series 2. Not a coincidence, surely. Especially when added to what else I'd just learned. Harper had been shagging Yasmin Pejman. He lived in Primrose Hill, where the victims had been discovered, and he was displaying an unusual level of interest in the case. Outside, the rain hammered down, the squall audible through the glass. I looked over him, taking in every detail, movement and twitch. Could he be the assailant? Was I next? Harper's hands were gripping tight on the wheel. His eyes were glazed. There were beads of moisture on his temple. He slipped his hand into his inside jacket pocket, and a swell of heat surged through me as he pulled it out. But then he took out a handkerchief and wiped the sweat off his forehead. Had I got it wrong? Was I misreading the signs? A shiver crawled down my spine. A pulse thudded in my neck. You must be the killer's type. No one knew where I was. Axel Montan had seen us leave his office together, but he had no idea Harper had offered me a ride home. Thanks to me, Isakson was clueless. And just like in my nightmare, there was no one around to raise the alarm. I had to do something. Fuck everything and run, or face everything and rise. Jack! My phone was still on silent. I slid my hand into my bag and hit Wolfie's number from the recently dialed list without the telltale beeps giving me away. Then I put it on speaker as he picked up. Dan Harper from S&M's giving me a ride home, I said quickly, getting my message out while I could. Ring you when I get in. Harper's head jerked round, his mouth tight. 2 minutes later, we were on Euston Road. Was it a coincidence, or had my call had an effect? Either way, I was feeling pretty clever.
Would you look at this weather?
Harper was back to making small talk. After a few minutes of shallow chat, he gave up and put the radio on.
This is Mellow Magic with your favourite timeless, relaxing classics.
Marylebone Road, over the flyover, onto Harrow Road, then Warwick Avenue, Bloomfield Road, Delamere Terrace, and left for home. Harper idled his engine as I walked up the steps. It was only as I shut the heavy communal door behind me that I registered a troubling fact. Dan Harper knew where I lived. If he wanted to get me on my own again, he'd know exactly where to find me. Maybe I hadn't been so clever after all. Chapter 75. I realize this is probably against the rules, but if you don't hear from me again, please contact the police and show them what I've written. It may not be just me in danger. My husband's name is... and our address is... Whatever happens, I want you to know how grateful I am for all your amazing support. You really have been a lifeline for me. Wish me luck. Chapter 76. Bloomfield Villas, London, 2155. I grabbed the post from the mailbox in the hall, my blood still up from what had happened in the car. But now I was behind closed doors, I couldn't help thinking I'd got riled over nothing. Up to high dough, Duncan would have said, likely followed by, your head's all minced up. What's wrong with me? Letting a civilian give me the heebie-jeebies like that? So, he drives a 3 Series and took me down a few back streets. Big whoop. I mean, he doesn't even fit the profile, for Christ's sake. And as for being over-interested in the case, well, if he was banging Pejman, it'd be weird if he didn't want to get the inside line. I stomped upstairs, getting crosser with myself with each step. It wasn't that I'd let fear cloud my judgment. It was that I'd felt frightened at all. I should give Isakson a heads up about him and Pejman, I thought. But how do I do that without giving up where I got my intel? I'd feel his boot in my arse if he found out what I'd done this evening. But keeping the information to myself would be worse. Sighing, I dug my phone out of my bag. See if we can get a warrant to search Dan Harper's phone and laptop. I think he might be Mr. Big. SMS 2158. I kept explanations out of it. If he asked for one, I'd put it down to profiling. And no need to mention the Bimmer from yesterday. I don't even know for sure it was following me. And if tonight's anything to go by, the whole thing may very well have been a figment of my fugazi imagination. I turned the key in the lock. Home, sweet home, I thought, pushing the front door open. It was instant. I put my bag down softly on the ground and stood in the entrance. My senses turned up all the way. It was faint, the ghost of a scent, but unmistakable all the same. Cigarettes. I don't smoke. My father had a 60-a-day habit. He lit up every morning while he made his toast. It killed him in the end, a pulmonary embolism. I'd just turned 11. His death sunk me. There's no one more anti-cigarettes than me. I hate the fucking things. So who'd been smoking in my flat? And where were they now? Chapter 77. I held in the latch, closed the door quietly, and turned the deadbolts. If someone was in here, I didn't want them leaving before I'd had a chance to get a good look at them, and preferably ask them a few questions too, in my own inimitable way. Back against the wall, listening for movement, I allowed my eyes to adjust, then moved away from the door, keeping the lights off. The dark would work in my favour. No one knows this flat better than me. Stepping 90 degrees away from the wall, tucking my elbows in and keeping my front foot parallel to my line of sight, I cleared the corner into the living room, scanning each slice of the pie in a swift vertical motion. I knew what I was doing, but I didn't have a weapon. That put me at a disadvantage. Leaning in the direction I was going so I'd see an intruder before he saw me, I inched towards the kitchen. The door was shut. Was he in there? Heart thundering, I turned the knob and pushed the door wide to expose the whole room and maximize the element of surprise. I scanned the area, moving fast. The fatal tunnel's not somewhere you want to linger. Clear. Without taking my eyes off the door, I grabbed a steak knife from the wooden block on the counter. It wasn't as sharp as the FS dagger I keep under my bed, or as powerful as a pump-action shotgun, but I could do some damage with it all the same. I moved back to the hallway, keeping to the left but away from the wall, aware that, as I was approaching the centre, I was stepping into another danger zone. There was no T-section, at least, but their narrowness makes passageways the riskiest part of any building. Knife raised, I pivoted round the corner into the bedroom, zigzagging as I entered, making sure my feet didn't cross over and compromise my balance. I explored the room and hiding places. Then I spun round the corner into the bathroom. The shower curtain was pulled across, and there was a bulk concealed behind it. I tightened my grip on the knife and yanked it across. There was no one there, just a basket of wet laundry waiting to go in the dryer. I lowered my weapon. I may not have company, but the cigarette smell showed someone had definitely been here. Chapter 78. I put the knife back in the kitchen, grabbed my black Maglite from the hall cupboard, then went to the bathroom to get some face powder and a makeup brush, turning on all the lights along the way. The place was now crime scene bright. There was no need for quiet, but I moved slowly. I didn't want to miss anything, not least because I had no way of knowing who'd been here or what they'd been after. My instincts told me this was about sunlight, but fact is, it could just as easily be about the Primrose Hill killer. I've had a murderer on my doorstep before. In this job, you don't get to draw a neat line between work and home. For the second time that night, my overheated brain was zeroing in on Dan Harper. He knows where I live, I thought again. Question is, had he known before he'd offered me a ride home? Or what about Watkiss? The guy had a pack-a-day pucker and the yellow teeth to match, not to mention a gripe with me. He didn't seem like the type to do his own dirty work, but that didn't mean he hadn't been here. I twisted my hair up in a knot and let it fall. There was no point playing guess who in the dark. If I wanted answers, I'd need to look for clues. I opened the front door and shone the torch at an oblique angle on the external locks, scanning for scratches. The intruder must have picked the lock. Cat burglars don't tend to crawl through windows 5 floors up. And there was no broken glass to suggest this guy was any different. But if he had picked the lock, there was no sign of it. Nor could I detect any latent finger marks on the door or metal surround. Admittedly, I'd dusted for them with face powder and a makeup rather than Zephyr brush. But still. I dropped to my knees, examining the floor for footmarks and fibre clumps with my torch. But I couldn't find anything. I couldn't see any traces of ash either. Whoever had invaded my drum was a professional. They knew what they were doing, and although they'd left a whiff of fags behind, it was highly unlikely they'd actually sucked on their cancer sticks in here. Instead, the smell had probably transferred from their clothes. Smoking dulls the senses. If the intruder had a long-term habit, he wouldn't be aware of the stink he was trailing. The absence of marks and scratches showed he'd been careful. He'd worn shoe covers and gloves, not just to avoid leaving behind evidence, but also so I wouldn't know my home had been violated. At first glance, nothing was out of place. My MasterCard was on the side in the kitchen by some cash, and my Thomas Sabo charm bracelet, a birthday present from Duncan, was on my dresser. That ruled out basic robbery. But it didn't explain what the intruder had been after. I walked round the flat, comparing everything to how I'd left it. My jotter pad was off-kilter by a few degrees. My desk drawer hadn't been shut all the way, and my copy of Signature Killers was now sitting on the shelf between Mindhunter and Whoever Hunts Monsters, whereas this morning, Mindhunter had been in the middle of the sandwich. Whoever had been here was looking for something, and they'd been through my papers. Though without a magnetic wand and BVDA galifter, there was no way of knowing who that person was. Ding dong! My heart bounced. A shadow moved under the door. It was coming up to 2300. Hardly the hour for social calls. So who was outside? And what did they want? Chapter 79. I glanced quickly through the spy hole, well aware how I'd play this game if I were on the other side of the door. A bullet to the eyeball is not a pleasant way to die. There was no one there, and yet there had to be. Bells don't ring themselves. How should I do this? If I went to my bedroom for the FS dagger, they could break down the door and catch me on the back foot. No, much better to go on the offensive, I thought, grabbing the folding umbrella from the radiator. It wasn't exactly a deadly weapon, but it had served nicely as a bat. A swipe to the head followed by a well-aimed kick to the groin, and my assailant would be on the ground before he could say my name. I took up my position and yanked the door open, jumping back quickly to free up the space between us, giving me room to strike. Jack! The umbrella clattered as it hit the floor. What the fuck are you doing here? He looked up from where he was crouching on the ground, doing up his laces. All messy hair and not so designer stubble. Well, that's nice, isn't it? My heart was still thudding.